Chapter 77. Blind Reparations. It was an irony of history that the Allied intransigence in squeezing the German lemon until the pip squeaked brought some unexpected benefits to Germany. Saddled with astronomical reparations, the Germans were forced to work night and day. Eventually, the axiom that a nation's wealth is in its workforce would prove correct. Germany would survive. On the other hand, the Allies, particularly the French, practically downed their tools at the prospect of endless billions coming their way. So much had been clamored about the billion-dollar bonanzas that the general attitude became lax, industry and productivity sank to dangerously low levels. Why work when untold billions would befall them like manna from heaven? It is likely that if France had not been granted German billions by the Versailles Treaty, it would have been 100 times more dynamic at the beginning of 1940 when it was overwhelmed by the Wehrmacht in a matter of weeks. The French had the misfortune to be led by billion-chasing demagogues in the 1920s and the Jewish Marxist Leon Blum in the 30s, all peddlers of illusion and defeat. The decline of France during those 20 years of mismanagement was amazing. Although the Germans had a mediocre government in the 1920s, that did not stop them from working. Beset on every side, the Germans relied only on themselves to escape from an intolerable situation. The Allies relied on illusions, the Germans, on work. In order to realize their illusions, the Allies descended on Germany like vultures, fighting over mines, patents, and factories. Article 8. Clause 3 of the treaty gave the Allies Germany's merchant navy. The British had already pocketed all the German warships. Germany gave to the Allies all the ships of its merchant navy over 1,600 tons and 1/4 of its fishing fleet. The order not only included ships flying the German flag, but also any vessel belonging to German citizens, even if it were flying an other country's flag, either on the high seas or under construction. Germany was also ordered to build 200,000 tons a year in its shipyards for the Allies' benefit. This was more than half of Germany's pre-war production. Thus, Germany would not have enough ships to transport its necessary imports. This was a deliberate move to force Germany to rely on foreign ships for its trade and supplies. Merchant fleet operators seized the opportunity to charge exorbitant rates, which the Germans had to pay in hard currency. There was no limit, and in Kane's words, they charged as much as they could extort. The Economic Consequences of the Peace, page 62. After confiscating the German merchant navy, the Allies proceeded to confiscate private property all over the world. During past wars, foreign property had been sequestered until the ratification of peace treaties, when it would revert to its legitimate owners. This time, however, German property was being permanently confiscated. The Allied powers reserved the right to keep or dispose of assets belonging to German citizens, including companies they control. Article 267b. This wholesale expropriation would take place without any compensation to the owners. Articles 121 and 297b. As if this were not enough, the Germans remained responsible for the liabilities and loans on the assets that were taken from them. Profits, however, remained in the hands of the Allies. Thus, private German property and assets were confiscated in China, Articles 129 and 132, Thailand, Article 135 to 137, Egypt, Article 148, Liberia, Article 135 to 140, and in many other countries. Germany was also precluded from investing capital in any neighboring country, and had to forfeit all rights to whatever title it may possess in these countries. The Allies were given free access to the German marketplace without the slightest tariff, while products made in Germany faced high foreign tariff barriers. Articles 264-267 established that Germany undertakes to give the Allies and their associates the status of most favored nations for 5 years. Germany, of course, had no such status. Altogether, there were 27 nations, the bulk of the world's trading nations, entitled to export whatever they wanted to Germany without paying a dime. German goods were subject to endless customs roadblocks. Wilson could not help but warn his colleagues, "Gentlemen, my experts and I consider this measure to be wrong. We believe you will be the first to suffer from it. The Allies were unconcerned. They went on to take control of the German customs in the Rhineland as well as on Germany's rivers. The Rhine, the Danube, the Elbe, and the Oder would be placed under the control of Allied commissions. In all these commissions, the Germans would have only minority participation. Foreigners who had not the slightest experience with the German economy would preside with dictatorial powers. Keynes elaborated on this great river robbery. In each case, the representation was arranged to place Germany in a minority position. The Elbe Commission gave Germany 4 votes out of 10, the Oder 3 votes out of 9, the Rhine 4 out of 19. Thus, many of the local and internal affairs of Hamburg, Magdeburg, Dresden, Stettin, Frankfurt, and Breslau would be submitted to a foreign jurisdiction. The situation would be the same if the powers of continental Europe were controlling the Thames Commission or the Port of London. Article 339 of the treaty ordered that 20% of the river freighters would be chosen from among the most recently built and confiscated by the Allies. Even water rights were monopolized by the Allies, under Article 358. Just as significant was the ransacking of Germany's coal and iron mines, the mainstay of its economy, the British seizure of the German Navy even before the peace conference, and the fraudulent transfer of Eastern Upper Silesia to Poland. Germany was suddenly deprived of nearly 61 million tons of its coal production, 3.8 million from Alsace-Lorraine, 13.2 million from Saarland, and 43.8 million from Upper Silesia. Germany's coal production before the war was 191.5 million tons, it was now left with 118 million after the balance had been confiscated. In addition, the French government was guaranteed 80,000 tons of ammonium sulfate, 35,000 tons of benzene, and 50,000 tons of tar by the treaty. Germany's consumption of coal before the war had been 139 million tons. Article 8 of the treaty required that Germany export 40 million tons of coal to the Allies each year. This was almost half of what Germany required for its own needs. Keynes said, "Germany cannot and will not grant a yearly contribution of 40 million tons of coal." The Allied ministers who said that Germany could have certainly lied to their own people. The Allies meant to subordinate Germany industry to their exclusive use. It was totally aberrant, Germany could not part with the coal needed for its industrial survival. Keynes was quite clear, Germany, if she is to subsist as an industrial nation, just cannot export coal in the coming years. Each million tons going out from Germany does it at the price of closing a factory. The Economic Consequences of the Peace, page 81. Germany was experiencing near-famine conditions. It was at this moment the Allies decided to confiscate a substantial part of what was left of Germany's livestock. The American representative Thomas Lamont recorded the event with some indignation. "The Germans were made to deliver cattle, horses, sheep, goats, etc. A strong protest came from Germany and dairy cows were taken to France and Belgium, thus depriving German children of milk." What happened in Paris, page 220. Food shortages were such that 60,000 Ruhr miners refused to work overtime unless they were paid, even in the form of butter. When it became obvious that Germany would not be able to deliver the coal ordered by the treaty, the Allies lowered the amount from 43 million tons to 20 million tons. In 1918, Germany derived 75% of its iron ore from Alsace-Lorraine, 21.1 million tons, out of a national total of 28.6 million. In order to keep its factories running, Germany should have been allowed to exchange its premium Westphalian coal for some of the iron ore from its former Alsace-Lorraine province. Without such an exchange, German metallurgy would come to a halt. The French government was adamantly opposed to any arrangement posing a threat to its newly acquired steel mills. The cooperation which would have helped both countries gave way to cutthroat competition with counterproductive duplication. In the long run, the French government came out the loser, but there again hatred was more important than common sense. Keynes commented philosophically, "People have invented methods to impoverish themselves and harm each other. They prefer hatred to individual happiness. Economic Consequences of the Peace, page 87. Tardieu saw Germany's loss of steel production as a victory for his policy of revenge. The Allied seizure of the German fleet was effected in the same spirit. Tardieu explained, "We did not want money as a consideration for sunken vessels, we wanted ships to make money." Peace, page 450. The British seized a total of 2 million tons of shipping capacity, while the French had to make do with 410,000 tons. Now, if the Germans wanted to bring food to a starving population, they had to pay freight in gold marks for the use of their confiscated vessels. On the other hand, when Germany had to export its coal under the provisions of the treaty, it was only credited with a third of its market value. The remaining two-thirds went to reduce ever so slightly the billions Germany was ordered to pay for reparations. It was totally arbitrary, and in the light of the suffering of the German population, children were actually dying of cold for lack of fuel, it was utterly immoral. Tardieu, the Masonic Grand Master, gave brotherly love and charity short shrift when he read the Allied ledger. German capital has suffered in other ways, starting with the confiscation of its foreign assets. Approximately 5 billion marks was realized from its real estate. Assets sequestered by the Allies and their associates represent from 11 to 13 billion, and foreign loans come to 2 billion, altogether a total of 20 billion. The loans which had been made by Germany to the Allies, amounting to 12 billion, cannot be deducted from this loss since Article 261 of the treaty had transferred them to the Allies. German capital loss therefore comes to 20 billion at the foreign level. To these 20 billion one can add other losses easily calculated: destruction of stocks, 20 billion, damages caused by the Russian invasion of East Prussia, 2 billion. According to Article 235, Germany must deliver to the Allies, before May 1, 1921, 20 billion marks in gold or its equivalent in ships, cattle, manufactured goods, etc. Altogether, this means a 62 billion capital loss for Germany. Peace, page 358. If Tardieu and the Allies were pleased with Germany's loss of 105 billion marks as well as with the additional burden of 151 billion marks in war loans, it was a terrible and fitting punishment. They also wanted Germany to abide by all the terms of the treaty. It was an absurdity that only blind hatred could produce. The Allies were in the position of a slave master consumed by hatred and torn between wanting his slave dead and highly productive at the same time. Germany, deprived of its assets, its coal, its iron, its livestock and its ships, was still expected to produce billions to compensate the victors. When the obvious became apparent even to the Allies, Tardieu devised a formula, reducing German consumption. According to Tardieu, the near-starving Germans were eating too much and consuming too much of everything. Germany was ordered to tighten its belt by a third, from 33 billion to 22.8 billion. But what would these paltry 10.2 billion marks represent in the overall debt of thousands of billions? A drop in the ocean, which would, however, cause cruel privations among the general German population. Meanwhile, the French and British electorates were clamoring for the Huns' billions. Their politicians had whipped them up into a frenzy of greedy expectations, to the chant of, "The Huns will pay." If they did not, the politicians promised, "We'll go to Germany and help ourselves." Tardieu declared to the voters, "Our iron production has jumped from 21 million tons before the war to 43 million, cast iron from 5 to 10.5 million tons, steel from 4.5 to 9 million tons. Wool increased by 25% and cotton by 30%. The recovery of Alsace-Lorraine puts us on a par with Germany for the production of cast iron, of which it produced three times more than we, and Great Britain, which produced twice as much. We are first in iron ore, second in cast iron and steel. We can export up to 20 million tons of iron ore. Our cotton exports have doubled overnight. Today's wealth, but above all tomorrow's wealth, will be the consequence of the Versailles Treaty." Thanks to the spoils of Versailles, the French government had rebuilt most of the war-damaged areas of France, yet it demanded more and more billions. Although the war was not fought on their side, the British politicians were no less demanding than the French. Lloyd George had promised the British electorate to demand and get $120 billion from Germany. Wilson had timidly admonished Lloyd George that such a demand would contravene what we had led the enemy to expect, and that now we could not change our minds simply because we had force on our side. What happened in Paris, page 211. Fortunately, relatively speaking, for Germany, Lloyd George was a true politician, adept in twisting and breaking electoral promises. Reality forced him to lower his demands to $10 billion, which was the amount that John Maynard Keynes had calculated in the first place. French politicians, for their own part, had no intention of compromising; hatred was their only reality. They demanded that Germany pay $350 billion. The press still found the amount scandalously low. Certain French delegates expressed their doubts privately: how could a ton of meat be produced from a chicken? But they would have been torn to shreds if they had expressed their views publicly. The American delegation tried to moderate these fantastic amounts, to no avail. Wilson was finally resigned. The French government is sailing a perilous sea, always relying on popular feeling. It has to govern according to the wind.